Hey, this is Gareth Webb, and you are listening to Breakout, a show aimed at cutting through the hiring noise and breaking down best practices. We'll also be tapping into the minds of other industry leaders so you can ensure your business makes the right critical hires the right way.
All right, well, let's dive into it. Today, the topic that I wanted to cover with you is how to source effectively. And I wanted to dive a little bit into just the OutScout sourcing process. And I'll start with a little anecdote that I remember you bringing up a little while back from one of our previous companies we worked with. They were a startup, I think Series B company. The conversation was centered around, you know, I don't think we had placed them yet, but they were looking at kind of reevaluating their agency list. We were one of a few other agencies that they had been working with at the time. However, they wanted to keep us on because, you know, they mentioned that the quality of candidates we sent over were always very high, and, you know, we might've sent like three over and they wanted to interview all three versus another agency partner would send 10 or 15, and maybe they would have one they wanted to actually interview and pull into their process from that. So I wanted to dig into that and just kind of like get your viewpoint on, okay, so we've got something here that, you know, we're not a volume agency, right? And the long-term vision of OutScout is to never replace that. It's something separate. So within the sourcing and research process that you do and have the team do now, I wanted to kind of break that down a little bit with you and just pull some aspects out of like what makes this process different and how are we able to kind of source and find people with that level of, you know, wanting to interview someone at, you know, three of three versus a much lower rate with others.
Yeah. That client, we felt like they were using, we heard stuff and that they were basically gone overboard with partners. So we called it out and we're like, hey, look, we don't want to be one of like five plus partners or even probably more than three. Like, we're happy to be one of two or three typically. And just gets very messy for everybody. And I get why clients want to do it because they kind of think best coverage. And these guys did decide to trim down their partners and we hadn't placed with them, but they really valued the partnership based on the hit rates, the ratios of who they felt was coming through was consistently a higher bar. There was no volume. We could do, at times we need much better volume, but we are always, that can really backfire, especially with certain types of clients. This is all part of the experience design that's been going on over the last couple of years with our product and how we match that with people within the business and our longer term vision of, you're having better data sets that are not just a database. Cause I mean, this is the thing that like, I think clients are just so bored of is like, an agency will say, well, we have a database of X thousand software engineers and X number of people in New York or X product managers in the Bay Area. But that doesn't really mean anything because you can just buy that data and it's in LinkedIn or it's in various other sources that are out there now with different kinds of like sales intelligence tools. So it's really like the augmentation process of how you can structure data. LinkedIn is a bunch of, you know, like, and I think what we also want to do is just get rid of the word sourcing. Like, we don't want our clients to ever have to source, and we don't really want to have to ever source because it's kind of just an old fashioned term of scouring through long lists and, you know, Boolean searches and all that kind of stuff, which relies on resume writing and it relies on a bunch of other things. So yeah, I think what we get right is like, uniformity and of like how we calibrate quality among the team. And like, especially with a new client, it's that initial calibration process. So reviewing sample profiles, gauging what's a yes or a no, or a maybe, and knowing like where that line is between a yes and a no, and sometimes that you then have to just say, look, you need to talk to the person if you're not sure. We had actually a really good conversation yesterday with a new client that's subscribed to our platform and making several critical, like, senior level hires or like director level, and the president of the business was on there, and he's like, look, here's how I do things, and it's very similar to us. He was like, look, three is kind of like, I'm probably not going to interview a three out of five based on resume profile and fit. Like, he will make that call. A three and a half, he will speak to them. Four is an absolute yes to interview, and a four and a half to five is like really excited about interviewing them and probably wanting to, probably already knowing based on the profile that they will be a good functional fit. It's just whether they're a good business team, like fit, culture, ad, type of profile. So he was like, look, I'm looking for fours ideally, like fours and fives. I'll interview a three and a half. A three for me is a no. And that's very useful to know. But then obviously you need to say, well, what's going to be three and a half to four plus? And so then we did some tightening. And so this is what's not in the job description that they write. And it's like what we build into our platform is like, what's the things that you categorically need to see? Like industry background, number of years of experience, like kind of like the data that the candidate provides on, say it's a marketing position, like what revenue numbers have they generated, what size team, how hands-on, budgets. So it's just people are looking for, they don't necessarily need the same, like they're not looking always to hire from a competitor, but they're looking for similar. They're looking for speed of onboarding, speed of traction, and then if people are kind of versatile enough to like get on board and learn things themselves. So I think that's what we look for. Like, it's not as simple as top school and big brands. Like, that really doesn't work with lots of our clients because it's like startups, scale-ups, mid-market clients. But it's just identifying the stack ranking and the identification of core musts versus, and some people might think I'm just spouting the obvious here for like talent acquisition, but I don't think I am, because I think a lot of people will be seduced by brands or someone's worked somewhere, and they might be a very strong individual, high caliber individual, but they're not a good match for a position or a client at a particular point in time. So I think we're good at identifying that. And that's part of the matching process and the prioritization of the three categories we have in our platform. So if you're absolutely the four to five, and I say 90 to 100% of spec, which is what the client was kind of getting to, he's been a bit more flexible, I guess, then we have top five matches. In the middle, we have we have top five close matches, which is, in my mind, 80 to 90% on the specification from the client, or in his eyes, probably like 3.5 to 4 or 4 to 4.5. And then the curveballs for us is not like substandard, it's just different. So curveball matches for us are like, hey, like this person's from a different industry, or they're more junior, they're on the track, but they're not quite where you've asked for, but they probably could do it, given, depending on your ability to support or on board. So yeah, in short, it's just an understanding, like the reason we have good match to interview ratios is because we are constantly trying to mine for an audience of talent, or community of talent, or clusters of talent, as we call it, which is like the most likely to fit with the similar types of clients and positions. And it's not, it's like a different, it's going to be a change for them moving companies, but it's not going to be so dramatically different. It's, you know, it's in the same size or growth mode that they're used to, or or it's like, it just makes sense. And I think a lot of people, you have to be pretty good understanding the client. You have to be good understanding their product, their tech stack, their commercial model. So it's not just taking a written job spec and then trying to match it. That's what a lot of agencies do. Search firms obviously go bigger into like the business plans and the shareholder kind of intention. We are trying to match critical hires, which means we're trying to match like for like as much as possible, but with some sensible flexibility around choice.
Got it.
And I think that is in the, that's us being quite demanding up front. Like, hey, we want you to build your client profile page, your the position, okay it with us. We all agree it. Had a call with a new client 2 weeks ago who was like, yeah, Gareth, I'm just actually very bored of talking to different like agencies and search firms who is just a lot of words. He said, there's no differentiator, there's no different approach. And he's like, but if I use your platform and I get to actually just tell you what I need and want, and we kind of like can have a shorter conversation around where the areas of flexibility are, and then it's more like that's what the candidate sees. It's a different kind of experience.
Got it. I guess one of the questions or follow-up questions I have with that would be, this might be for, so I know our platform piece is a little bit different than experience than what other agencies would be providing, right? But within the like searching or sourcing process, if you want to call that itself, especially for those like one-off roles who maybe aren't in our current talent pool that we kind of leverage, can you go into any, I guess I'm trying to understand what the differences are, or are there any differences in the actual search process itself? Or is it more of like, because you mentioned, you know, kind of going beyond the job spec prior to and doing initial calibration calls, and like, it seems like there's a difference there, like upfront, and like just the level of depth that we go in with our clients to make sure that we're on the same page prior to kicking off the search. But once we get to search, if we need to go that route, what are the differences there, if there are any?
Yeah. So, I mean, just to clarify, so obviously we have candidates signing up to join our platform. Some of them just find us, and we've had a good traction with that. Then there's plenty that we're inviting. So we look at people, we find people, we hear of people, and we say, hey, look, like you're spot on for our demand. So we have the two sides, which is the client demand and then the talent supply. Yeah, to put it crudely, there is, it does switch the other way as well with candidate demand and job supply. But we have criteria which people have to hit to be approved into the talent network in the first place. And some of that is a bit brutal and elitist, but like we are in the world of business. And so like, you know, our clients, doesn't matter how hard we fight for somebody, this just a disclaimer, like we might say somebody's great and they've had a couple of like pieces of misfortune. One or two is fine, but like any candidate that's got sort of consistent job moves of between 1 to 2 years or I'd say 2 to 3 is okay if there's actually been more towards the 3 years and there's been some substantial wins in that time, because you can get like a lot done in that period of time. But by and large, our clients who are paying extra on top, right, they're paying on top of the salary or they're paying a large subscription to us, they want to pay that money for access to things that they can't otherwise find. And they also want to basically pay money up front to minimize risk. It is also what it comes down to. So if we show them people, say we show them a director and they've done like 5 stints in the last 10 years, the question is why? And it's like, we got laid off, or got acquired, got whatever, like part of an M&A deal, or like they got headhunted a few times. It's like, well, that pattern is, it rarely stops. So, you know, that's why people don't love it. You can do, you basically, in any big job, you probably spend the first year honestly finding your feet and implementing stuff or fixing stuff. Yeah, that's the reality. The second year is where things should kick on and there's results, bigger results. And then year 3, 4, 5 is when you prove that people can go through cycles. They don't just want an easy ride. So in most of our clients who are doing very difficult things, and obviously in the last few years in difficult conditions, they want people that are like mentally gritty. And the words grit and scrappy come up a lot, which basically means like do hard things with not a lot and be consistently good. You know, even bigger clients of ours, like $1 to $10 billion market caps, they want resilient, gritty, smart people who don't just need money and teams to support them. So how do you identify that? One of the ways we identify it is a combination of solid tenures, which we highlight on our on profiles ourselves. You know, anything 3+ years is solid in this day and age. I think 5+ years, you've got someone who's like been really well looked after, done great work, especially if they've been promoted once or twice. And so there again are signals of success, which is what our clients want. So anyone out there that's like listening and sort of been in their job a year or two and isn't loving it, but isn't hating it, should ask themselves a question: what can I do to make it better? And what can I do to make a big impact? Because A, it improves my situation right now, but B, it's going to improve my situation and my value later down the line when I get approached or if I decide to move on or do my own thing. So yeah, that's one of the things that clients want and we have to identify, and we have to be quite clear cut about that. Like if a candidate has had multiple jobs in multiple companies in short stints of time, we cannot accept them and approve them and then match them to clients. Like it's just because it's a waste of their time and a waste of ours. And then it gets to the client and they say no, and we can't change their mind. It's just their hard, fast rules. Doesn't get advertised on LinkedIn too much, but that is the deal.
What else? So you mentioned, go ahead. Sorry.
No, I was going to say, you asked about like, how do we do?
Yeah. Because the 10 years, like one piece, right? Like what's the,
other 10-year proof of success, i.e. promotion or multiple promotions, is a great one, right? Because and it depends on which company. Like if they've been in a 3-person company, they got promoted from analyst to director in 5 years, and maybe not so great, but depending on what that business is doing. But yeah, multiple promotions. And then it's like, is it sensible? So it doesn't have to be the same kind of company, but like it helps if it comes from, so we look at sector, which is like obviously software or internet or hardware. Then subsector, so is it like public safety? Is it educational technology? Is it process automation, AI, like fraud detection, whatever it may be? Like most of the time when people are paying for senior talent, they don't necessarily have to come from a competitor directly, but they should come from a domain where they are going to thrive when they join. Unless the client specifically doesn't want it, like say they want someone in design that's designing consumer apps because they want to consumerize their enterprise product a little bit more. So that happens. So yeah, it's just like, so longer term, we want to have every single technology professional in the right bucket of function and subsector, and then like matching can happen faster. I think that's what we do really well already. And longer term, we will do that using technology, if want of a better word, AI, but obviously with a human overlay to make sure that makes sense. And yeah, and then the bit that we can't necessarily ever build into technology is like, is somebody going to get along with somebody? Like, you know, there's other technology that could do that with personality types and stuff like that, but part of our profile building is like, what do you want out of a culture and what do you not want? And so then, you know, we know what people don't want because we have candidates telling us all the time what they don't want when they are entertaining a search or themselves for a new position. But yeah, it's obviously very, very like multi-layered, and some of it can be done by technology or screening technology or just like extracting more context, and then other bits has to sort of sometimes happen with humans.
Got it. So there's this kind of initial calibration piece that you mentioned, sure that we're going beyond the job spec, understanding some of the preferences, calibrate with some quick profiles to get going quickly, then going into more of the traditional like search sourcing if needed, if they're not in a talent pool, looking at various things such as tenure, previous proof of success or promotions, going into industry layers, finding something that feels similar that would be transferable at the senior level. Identifying individual preferences, cultural wants, not wants. I guess one of my follow-ups here is those all kind of feel like, and again, this is coming from someone who is learning, but you know, not in the day-to-day of the sourcing piece of it. Those feel like things that I would probably try and do anyways. So I guess my question is like, what's the difference factor or the secret sauce that you think like separates this process from, you know, another recruiting agency's process if they do have kind of similar criteria, or do they have similar criteria? Maybe it's not as simple or elementary as I'm painting the picture.
No, I mean, look, there's some good, I think there's some good agencies out there, and there's some really good agency recruiters who have spent years building really tight networks of people. And then you've got search folks. Some of those folks probably graduate into the world of executive search and become monster billers and know lots of people. But I think a lot of our clients just don't necessarily buy the spiel anymore. Like they, for a top, it's a bit like, the analogy I could give is like, say, IBM is not going to use a new or small accounting firm to do their auditing every year, right? They're just never going to do that. They're going to go and buy one of the big four. Like that's just career risk, makes sense. Big companies use big companies. But for hiring, it's a little different. Like you will get some private equity firms when they want to run a search for, say, a CMO or a CFO, they will go to a certain search firm. And that's never going to go away. We're not trying to really disrupt that. But the bit with the agency and the middle layer of search, the direct, like, you know, ICs, managers, directors, VPs, lots of clients don't want to be going out paying six-figure fees. Agencies are super hit and miss. Like you're relying on predominantly younger and like sales-oriented type folks. They're inconsistent. So the point for me is that like it's very difficult for clients to know, is the same thing happening? Is the same process happening? Is there uniformity of process and decision-making and consistency of who gets put forward? And clients want more than that. Like I know that, like we speak to them all the time. I think the piece that you mentioned of like secret sauce is probably in that consistency of like, well, every match, every profile has to, first of all, before it gets to a client, it's like, is it a high level, solid, strong candidate to begin with? And then once they're in the data set, half of the stress is kind of taken care of. So then it's more like, okay, it's not how good are they, it's, are they a good fit? And are they an appropriate match to be considered? And I think, you know, that's where a lot of agencies fall down is like they just use what they've got. So like candidates come in from an advert, they'll submit them. Like we may or may not do that if a candidate's got like more than two or three processes going on and they're mid-stage with stuff, we may say, actually, no, like that doesn't really work for the client because the likelihood of them being able to offer you and hire you is very, very, very low. So we use a bit more of like that as well around sort of some factors of predictability. It doesn't always work, but it's better than not. And then I think it's also just like we do things like, I'm sure other agencies do this, but like we, by standard practices, we look at like the recent hires, who have you hired recently and why, what made you hire them, and like trying to understand that as well, just so that we can see how people make a decision towards a yes. So that's some of the things that we do. Yeah, I think it's just like knowing if you kind of, the way I try to think of us is like being less of a, we're not there yet, but like being less of a service provider to the technology industry is more being like a part of it and being knowing companies. Like quite often we will get on calls with clients and they'll tell us about what they want and stuff, and we'll mention companies that are doing sort of similar stuff to them and they won't know them, or there's VC firms that we work with and they're investing in similar products and they don't know them. So it's like we give added value because we're like constantly trying to stay one step ahead. And I think there's another piece there as well, you know, which is like the credibility and depth of understanding of the ecosystem, but not getting too carried away with that. Like, you know, we've had plenty of clients that want to hire a certain thing, let's say Golang for software engineering, and it's reasonably new, it's not like as many people out there as the clients would like, so we will match somebody that's say Java who wants to learn it, so we're trying to understand what you're trying to do here, and then there's somebody here that's really good Java engineer but wants to learn Golang, and we're like, well look, this is their intention, their preference is to go somewhere to learn Golang, could you do that? And that's something else. It's like they're like, yeah, we just want really good smart people. We can get them up to speed within a month or two if they're open to it. So yeah, I don't know, just a bit of expansive thinking, asking a question, suggesting matches, not just making, like, just taking the order and doing exactly what they ask all the time. I think that we're not perfect at it yet. Like, there's so much more we want to do and build, and there's more data that we want to go and ingest. You know, like, we want Crunchbase API so that we can get more information on companies up front, and then when candidates sign up, like, we know where they work and we can see what kind of subsector of technology that is. Like, all that stuff is in the works, which that will really be the secret sauce. Whereas, like, we're kind of a step behind that at the moment. But I think. Yeah, some people will listen to what I'm talking about and probably say, oh, that's bullshit. Like, it shouldn't be so objective. It should be really, it's really subjective, and people should just interview more people and take risks on hires. Like, I agree with that to an extent, but I also am pragmatic in that, you know, people want what they want. They're time poor. They want to see, if they put a position out there, they want to see five great people pretty quickly. And that's all that matters. And then they want to hire one. So we're not trying to save the world here. Like, we're trying to make the process faster, make sense, and keep the bar high, because people are just, they don't drop their bar, they just get annoyed and then they'll just go elsewhere. So, like, we're there to sort of give people what they want on both sides of the table.
Cool. Yeah, two other pieces I wrote down as you're kind of talking through all that, just additional depth of market expertise, being able to kind of be more of a partner and push back where we feel is appropriate, and then just a consistent process and depth of process. Cool. Well, I think it's a good time to switch over to our crowdsource Q&A. I've got two questions for you today. One of them kind of ties into a couple of the comments you had made earlier in our conversation. So, and this one kind of stems your comment here was around, you know, not having us not being like order takers, but also being more of a partner as well, and making sure we're able to kind of push back and set expectations with the clients or companies we're working with. So how might you go about setting expectations with hiring managers on, you know, time frame for hiring, number of candidates they should be expecting, market comp, things like that?
Yeah, comp, I think we're pretty good at, like, knowing comp range. Like, it is, you know, documented, and we have very good data points of what people are on, what they want, what we've hired at. Because we have a range of clients, like, we know what the seed series A are paying. We know what the mid-market's paying. We had a call yesterday with series C looking for a VP of customer success, and they asked us and we told them. And then they were like, great, that actually matches exactly with what we had. So I think it was like 250 base, 400 OTE plus stock, and we're like, yeah, that's a solid, like, series A VP of customer success comp. So it's like, very confident that we've got our comp right. We're trying to productize that so anybody can come and find out, like, what they're worth and what they're earning, and that kind of stuff.
What happens in terms if of, like,
expectation managed?
What happens if, like, let's say in that situation they were not on the same page about comp, they're actually like, oh, we've only budgeted for, I don't know, let's say 180 or something lower, right?
That does happen. Yep. Yeah, that happens. I mean, I just have to tell them, like, you can't afford what you want. It's tough shit. Like, it's like, you know, I'm like, you will not be successful at making that higher at the level you want. And then, you know, people don't really get offended by that. I think they're just like, oh, we'd hoped we could do it with 180. And it's like, no, you can get a director or a senior manager or a director of customer success probably. But you won't get a VP at the level you're at with the revenue you've got. And also, it's quite easy to push back, especially if we know a company has a certain revenue number or they have a fundraise. It's like, okay, you just raised 50 million. So why are you trying to nickel and dime for a VP of customer success when that's probably the biggest thing for you is to stop losing customers, like, losing revenue, like, it's like, you know, reducing churn and upsell, cross sell, like, it's a very easy one to push back on there. I guess one of the ones that's a bit more challenging is like seed series A, where they're trying to hire leadership folks and engineers, and they, you know, they try and shave off 20 grand here and there because it can make a difference. Yep. So they might say, yeah, we need really top notch engineers and we're going to pay 150, 160. And we're like, that won't work. It doesn't matter, like, if you're seed or series A, you can't say you want top notch. and then be paying less than and whatever that number is. Like, and so we do tend to, you have to back everything up with data. So if it's no point in me just saying to people, oh, you're paying too low. The good thing is some of our pricing plans mean that we're clearly not trying to drive up salary. You know, I had that conversation with somebody yesterday, and that's why they like it. But at the same time, we have to have everybody be successful. And that means, like, you know, no one feeling hard done by with a low ball and all that kind of stuff. So yeah, showing people what salaries people are on and showing them sample profiles and saying, hey, look, here's what we think this person's on, or here's somebody we placed recently, this is what they got. Like, it, then people are okay. Like, we're not talking about personal finances. We're talking about people's business budgeting. So we have to be pragmatic. And then, you know, in terms of like how quickly, well, that depends on the role and skill set, the readiness, the availability of that skill set. You know, some engineering, some people with engineers, they want 5 engineers a week, if not more. And we can't, like, we never say yes to that. Our kind of magic number is like 2 to 3 really high profiles a week is where we try to get to. You know, and that there's only so many interviews that execs can do anyway in a week. So that number seems to be pretty good, like 2 or 3 interviews a week for a role. You know, then you're 3 weeks in, you've had 6 to 9 interviews, you should be close to knowing. And then unfortunately, you know, some positions are just a little more stringent. Like, the big one at the moment is, oh, we want people in the office 2-3 days a week. For a product and engineering driven business, that's very difficult because there's so many out there that don't care, and they'll let them do whatever they want. And so we still get some pushback. We have a head of product search, VP head of product search at the moment in the Bay Area. They want the person in the office 2-3 days a week, and people are not having it. Not the people they want anyway. There's people that will do it, but they're not all necessarily like quite hitting the mark. So that delays things. So yeah, it's just about like ironing. Like, we have this set of criteria that each company or each position is kind of scored on. Yeah, we have somewhere they're like dialed in on 2 cities. Like, right now we have 3 positions where Austin or Atlanta is the preferred location for hybrid, but they will look at remote as long as that person will travel to that city. So yeah, it's just trying to find out, like, again, this is a preference thing. This is why we ask candidates, what kind of like work mode do you want and how much would you travel? But it's now becoming a little bit silly where candidates are like, yeah, I will go into the office 1 or 2 days a week, but only on Tuesdays and Wednesdays, or Mondays and Thursdays. And it's like, okay, well, you know, you can't run a business pleasing everybody in that way. So yeah, we just have to be really clear about what's the kind of like restricting factors, like in office or hybrid, the skill set, the comp. The rest of the stuff we can't control, like culture and how people get along and all that kind of stuff. But we try to define all the controllables up front to then make matching a bit more sensible thereafter.
Cool. This is around candidate experience. So I guess I'll pose this more from, like, you know, what the team at OutScout, what we've kind of set up process-wise to help with this. But how are you ensuring you are maintaining contact with candidates and leaving them with a positive overall experience?
Yeah, I think most of the time it's really just about, this gets talked about a lot, but it's expectation management.
Cool. We are at time, so I'm going to leave you with our wrap-up question. We talked through quite a bit today, as I feel like we normally do. If our listeners could take away one thing from our conversation today, what would you want that to be?
I think it's hard to like wrap this up into a short-term thing, but I think just the commitment to quality, like whether you're a candidate, the commitment to quality is like building your own like profile and brand, which means sometimes not just thinking about everything you can gain from a situation, but like, you know, what can you add to yourself by learning and adding quality there? Because that means like over time, you like, it's the whole putting off the gratification, right? Like, the you will stand out more as a candidate if you can have slightly longer stints. Like, that's just what the data shows from what we see. And then the same with clients. It's like, the commitment to quality means probably just not, like we've talked about this before, but like getting everything dialed in at the start. Like, what do you want? What's gonna excite you? What's gonna make you want to interview and hire? Not trying to figure that out as you go. So the commitment to quality with the client is like, get things ironed out up front as much as you can. I mean, we've talked about that quite a bit, but then I think I'll just say like quality. If you get how you do anything is how you do everything, right? It's quite a good quote. It's quite a good phrase. And I think for hiring, it's really important. How you talk to people. So tone of voice, follow up, data management. Like, so just, I think that the commitment to quality is where the world gets frustrated with hiring because it's too slapdash, or it has been too slapdash. So there has not been a commitment to quality across the board. So it's just like, yeah, making sure people are reminding themselves and their teams of that and the commitment to quality. And that like each small thing can actually have a massive impact on your brand and your business and the people that join you and stuff like that. There was a good post yesterday on LinkedIn. One of my connections, she joined the new firm. She was like, this is why I joined this company. And she screenshotted her emails. And she'd signed the offer and joined. And she had like four or five emails from people that she met and joined. And I'm certain that doesn't happen across the board. And like, you know, I can only have a good, make a very good impression on new joiners.
Yeah, for sure. Awesome. Well, we will wrap up on that. Jared, thank you as always. And until next week.
Thank you very much. Cheers, Jake.